This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 82 of Metatrex, Trek FM's show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me, as always, is Zachary Frueling. Today, we're going to be discussing the Season 1 episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, The Arsenal of Freedoms. Well, Zachary, I was so glad when you said that you wanted to do this podcast on the episode, The Arsenal of Freedom. This is one of those great first season episodes, and as former, and I gotta keep bringing this up, as former Radio Shack sales reps, I know you and I especially appreciate the salesmanship that is on display in this episode. This is like the pushiest salesman ever. He's fantastic.
That actor, Vincent Schiavelli, who played that salesman, is a great go-to actor for any kind of interesting, weird, not quite creepy, but he makes a great kind of swarmy salesperson in this episode. I love him as a go-to character actor.
Yeah, he's relentless. He does not give up in the episode. He's going to close that sale no matter what. And I have to appreciate, again, as a sales rep, just how well a portrayal he gave.
Talk about the hard close.
It was a hard close. But in the end, he closed it, and that's all that matters.
Seriously speaking, though, over 2 years ago now, when you and I were planning this podcast, Metatrex, we put together a list of philosophical topics and episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation. Starting from the beginning, we would spend a lot of time like going through every episode of Star Trek looking for philosophical themes, things we knew implicitly, but we never took the time to write down. And we came up with a very long list of interesting philosophical concepts in the first season of Star Trek The Next Generation. And sadly, those interesting, useful, philosophically interesting themes are kind of overshadowed by the dramatic weaknesses of the first season of TNG. But if you go through the first season of TNG from episode to episode to episode, without fail, there's something interesting philosophically going on in those episodes. I'm glad we're finally like returning. I feel like we're returning to our Metatrex roots. Like, we wanted to start with these really rich themes, and the first season of TNG is where we started coming up with ideas for Metatrex, and then we never really talked about it very much, as luck would have it. So it's fun to finally return to the first season of TNG, and this is one of my favorite episodes from the first season. I always just remember how visually striking it is too, with those really cool looking drone devices.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And this episode, like so many of the episodes here in the first season of Star Trek The Next Generation, has so much packed into it. There's not just one philosophical nuance to it. It's got a half a dozen. And I really appreciate that about this episode and about a lot of the episodes within season one. And I really feel that, unlike the rest of TNG, that really begins to build its own tone and its own sense of autonomy, this first season, to me, best reflects, I think, what we got in the original series. The stories are very similar, and the tone is very similar, and it really feels, if I can coin the phrase, tossy. It feels tossy. It feels like an original series extension. But as Star Trek The Next Generation moved along, it really built its own autonomy and had its own feel and its own pacing and its own type of brand of storytelling, if you will. So I really appreciate that about the first season. And this episode is really just a brilliant, I think, example of what we're talking about.
When I was rewatching this episode, I was really struck by how relevant it still feels. On the one hand, this episode is very much a product of its time. We get kind of the Reagan era, Star Wars, automated warfare, shoot the things down from space kind of connotations that are going on. So this could have been a really dated kind of episode, but over the last couple of decades, we've seen progressive increases in our ability to automate warfare to the point where it really does potentially change our way of thinking about what it means to go to war, the risks that are involved, the personal virtues that are involved in taking those risks, and the utilitarian costs and benefits analysis of going to war. And all of that has only increased in the last couple of decades. So it seems more relevant than ever, even though it really is kind of a product of 80s era Reaganomics, you know, strategic defense spending.
Yeah, Zachary, in the business world, we talk a lot about projections and we do forecasts. And so I'm going to draw a little bit from my experience there to make this point. What Star Trek seems to do so well is to look at a topic in the real world, in the here and now, and make projections and build a forecast. For instance, in this case, you're right, it has very much a Reagan Star Wars kind of feel to it. We were really, for the first time, reaching into this bag of futuristic warfare, and we were starting to build these defensive ideas with this new emerging technology. But what they were able to do here in Star Trek is say, okay, what can we say about the possible dangers or the possible future ramifications of this type of warfare? And so what they did was they, you know, they put it in, you know, the 24th century, and they built a storyline about a race of people whose culture, whose existence was obliterated because of this high-tech weaponry that they developed. And what's really amazing, and this is how Star Trek, I think, has done this time and time again, we talk about things like, you know, the pads that they used in Next Generation. And, you know, now we have iPads and communicators, and now we have cell phones. Well, they were able to do that because they took existing concepts, existing ideas, and they forecasted on it. They did some projections, and they said, this is where this could plausibly go in the future. Well, here we are in the future, Zachary, and this idea of these drones that are able to fire on people, that's not a futuristic idea anymore. The danger is we can look back on that and say, wow, those little drones are cheesy, and yeah, they kind of look like, you know, the original H.G. Wells War of the Worlds spaceships from the old movie, from the 1950s or 60s. They had the old ships that looked like little bubbles with this phaser at the or laser at the bottom. You know, these things kind of look like that in this TNG episode. And you look at that and you go, oh, that's cheesy, or, you know, that's campy, or whatever. But in reality, Zachary, I think it was incredibly intelligent to be able to project on the technology that we had and come up with that, because now, yeah, those things don't look like little bubbles with lasers on them, but we are using drones to wage war. And how insightful of the writers of Star Trek, writers and creators of Star Trek, to be able to project that for the future.
I think you're right that this episode feels like a brainchild of the original series, insofar as the original series kind of bookends one side of the Cold War, like the beginning of the Cold War, right? When the idea for fighting a remote war was not a new idea. You know, since the 60s, we've been talking about lobbing missiles at each other across the ocean, right?
Sure.
So fighting a war by remote was not an idea that is tied to the 80s. But I think what you see in this episode is late era Cold War thinking. Not only do we try to fight wars by remote through these these drones that are novel at the time, these the idea of little small autonomous self-intelligent machine learning devices that are what we would call drone warfare today, these drones that can navigate around and do their thing. That was kind of a new idea in the 80s compared to what was going on in the 60s. But what I see in this episode, in addition to this progressive technological advancement of drone warfare, is the commodification of war. You know, if you think back to the 1980s, think how many companies owed their existence to Cold War defense spending government contracts to build weaponry, right? Here we essentially see one of these defense contractors, you know, some defense company building machines for anyone who wants to buy them. And the parts I find interesting about this episode are not just the technology, although we have seen that technology come to fruition. You know, after this episode was created, we had the first Gulf War. It was the video game war where we got to see the missiles zooming in by remote. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have to go send troops, as many troops on the ground. We could minimize our risks and maximize the return of warfare as a result of these devices. But all of that is intimately tied up with the commodification of war. Entire companies and employees owed their existence and their livelihood to creating weaponry used in a Cold War type environment.
I think it's important to say that these aren't original concepts for Star Trek. These concepts within this episode have been the stuff of television and movies in the 1980s. That, you know, I think of the movie War Games with Matthew Broderick. That's an early 80s movie that really did the same thing that we're seeing here in this episode of Star Trek. I think of the Terminator series, this dystopian future where the automation and artificial intelligences that emerge out of technology take over the world. And so these aren't original ideas for Star Trek, but it never ceases to amaze me how they're able to take something in the world. I mean, we're talking about, Zachary, this episode aired in April 1988. That was the spring of my junior year of high school. And so I remember this very, very well in terms of the episode being in first airing and seeing it on television and what it meant to me then. And again, not a new concept because we had, you know, the Terminator had already come out. And so these ideas were nothing new, but I think Star Trek did something very unique in that it took something, I think, that was very much top of mind with many, many people as these technologies emerged. And I think it was a very real projection that really wasn't so far into the distant future as it is, you know, a reality here now in the 21st century.
Star Trek doesn't often veer into the realm of technophobia. Generally, Star Trek's thesis about technology is that technology is largely used for improvement, medical improvement or improvements in travel or communication, to free up labor so we can play classical music on the Enterprise, that kind of thing, right? So Star Trek overall has a positive relationship with technology, and it doesn't veer into the realm of technophobia too much. I think this episode is a little more Terminator-like. These are, you know, self-intelligent machine learning devices that end up destroying the people on this planet. And of course, with Gene Roddenberry still kind of helming season one of TNG, this is very much Gene Roddenberry's, you know, brainchild, right? This is a commentary on us as a people. We might destroy ourselves if we let technology run amok, or if we don't learn to keep our technology in check. If we continue to build these devices used to kill each other, it might ultimately do ourselves in. So it's certainly a metaphor for us. And I'm trying to think of other instances in Star Trek where we get outright technophobia. I think the Borg are a great example of technophobia in Star Trek. You know, technology embedded in ourselves, losing our humanity. That's commentary on the dangers of technology as well. But those are aberrations in my mind in Star Trek. Most of the time, Star Trek tries to maintain a positive view of the potential role of technology, even in warfare, right? You know, when the Federation conceives of new weaponry, it's defensive weaponry that's used to maintain peace in the galaxy. They're not going out to conquer. We're not worried about the photon torpedoes, detonating themselves on the Enterprise, or the bioneural gel packs taking over the Enterprise. We don't worry about that too much, although those things happen once in a while. The computer core goes crazy or something and takes over the Enterprise. But but those are just isolated instances, and generally that's not a big fear, especially in TNG.
You made the statement that TNG's and Star Trek in general's relationship with technology has always been a relatively positive one, and they haven't delved a whole lot into technophobia. So this episode is unique in that regard. I mean, Captain Picard says within the episode, "You fools, your own creation destroyed you," and so there's this not so subtle commentary there about the dangers, the potential dangers of emerging artificial intelligence.
A little on the nose, Gene, a little on the nose.
It's a little on the nose, for sure. But I think that's very interesting when you contrast, say, Star Trek The Next Generation with, you know, one of its contemporaries, The Terminator. In Star Trek The Next Generation, it's interesting that technology very much is seen as a tool. And in some respects, with the exception of the ship's computer, I think that is incredibly intelligent. And then, of course, you have Data.
Who's not a Terminator.
Who's not a Terminator, but, you know.
Although I'd like to see that movie.
I can see Data saying, you know, hasta la vista, baby. But
that sounds like something they would have written into Generations.
And they should have. What a missed opportunity.
That is Data's emotion chip at work, for sure.
But, you know, the technology that we generally see inside of Star Trek is, Zachary, if I can use the term dumb, it's dumb technology. It's iPads and iPhones and we call it a smartphone, but really the smartest thing about it is that it's user-friendly. And it's a tool. It's not of itself intelligent. And that's largely the technology that we see in Star Trek. Here we find artificial intelligence that is adaptive and unable to distinguish between friend and foe. And I find that really fascinating here in this episode.
You made an interesting distinction just now between what I would call machine learning, dumb technology. No matter how razzle-dazzle it can seem, no matter how sophisticated, algorithms that learn and improve are fundamentally still not conscious, right? So there's machine learning in a dumb sense, and then there's artificial intelligence in a smarter sense. Data, you'd probably put in the category of an artificially intelligent being. Even the Terminator in the Terminator series is an artificially intelligent being. It's self-aware to some degree. But I don't get the sense from this episode that these devices, these drones, are self-aware beings. They're programmed. They have algorithms that improve, that learn from their mistakes, but they're not conscious of what they're doing. And also, kind of ipso facto, they're not conscious of the moral choice that they're making, that they're being programmed to execute.
Exactly. And our salesman in the episode says that once these are unleashed, the unit's invincible. It's the perfect killing system.
And even the salesperson is not artificially intelligent. He's more like a dummy. He's a puppet. He's supposed to stand there and, you know, continue doing the demo until the magic words are said. In this case, the magic words are, "I'll take one." And then he's like, "Oh, well, in that case, I'll call off the arsenal."
And I've worked for a few sales managers along the way who probably would have found that an admirable characteristic.
I think I used to be one of those guys at Radio Shack. Buy a cell phone now. Okay, I'll take one. Just leave me alone.
Well, you can't. I mean, and I've been a sales manager and a sales trainer for many, many years. I've got, you know, over 20 years experience in sales and sales management. And you do. You teach your sales reps to continue to probe, to get buy-in. And once you've done that, you just keep feeding the customer's responses back to them to remind the customer that they desire what it is that you're selling. And if you can get that buy-in, then, you know, if you can continue to probe and uncover need, then eventually you'll be able to close, and you continue to try to close.
Do you think that these techniques would have actually worked at Radio Shack? Like, I could imagine, like, taking a cell phone out of the back room, handing it to a customer, and like, "Oh, check out these great new cell phones. Oh, by the way, it's going to self-destruct in 30 seconds unless you buy one."
Maybe if they had done that, they wouldn't have closed all their doors. That's.
I know we keep making these Radio Shack jokes, but it's part of both of our experiences that we can't help ourselves.
It is, and I think anyone who's ever shopped at a mall or a shopping center, I think can can relate, whether you've walked in one or not.
Back in the 80s, you know, some guy at the Radio Shack corporate offices was like, oh, those little artificially intelligent drones in that episode of Star Trek, we got to get one of those. And we're going to call it Robbie the Robot Arsenal.
I'm surprised that they didn't sell them at Christmas time. I really am. They would have given me the remote and told me to operate it out in the food court to draw in business, I'm sure. But
well, Mike, I did want to talk a little bit about the drone warfare aspect in particular, because this is so much a part of how we think of war. And I think this has been a change that's happened in the 20th century, especially the late 20th century and definitely into the 21st century. Going to war used to mean a fair amount of risk was involved, right? You had to get an army, your own citizens, or a navy, or an air force, and you had to send them off into a hazardous area en masse, large numbers of people, where you know there are going to be casualties. A lot of those people are not coming back, except in body bags, and that's terrible and sad. And there was a risk involved, and with that risk, there were certain virtues that we thought people had in going to war. Being willing to risk your life to go out for some cause that we believed in, a just war in one form or another. What do you think about the concept of a drone? What do you think about the concept of drone warfare in general as it relates to the virtues of war? Certainly, if you're a country that needs to go fight a war, you want to minimize the risk to your own citizens. That seems clear, right? You want to, you know, accomplish whatever the goal is while minimizing your risks, and drones are one way to do that. But does waging war by remote or waging war by drone, does that undermine the personal virtues that we think of as the virtues of fighting a just war and the risks that are involved?
I think that's a great question, and it's one for which there are no easy answers. I will say that if there's anything about the old school of thought when it comes to warfare that I think is noble, it is this idea that on the battlefield, I do think that when you have two human beings staring each other down, and that's how warfare is waged, there's room for morality in the choices that are made on the battlefield. And I think that it becomes something that is very personal, and you become very personally engaged in it. What you're removing, I think, from that battle scenario when you're waging drone warfare is this idea that it's on a screen, and so it's somehow a little less human.
And yeah, I guess that's my worry, that, you know, when you're on a battlefield, I've never been on a battlefield, so I can only imagine this.
Exactly.
I should preface this speaking, that I know very little about, I have no firsthand experience of this. I only know, you know, secondhand experiences from other people and third-hand accounts. But I can imagine that when you are on a battlefield with a lot of personal risk and a lot of fear, and you're seeing the faces of the enemy, even at a great distance away, you know they're real people because they're there and they're dying in front of you, that has to reinforce the idea that this war better be worth it, that the cause is so important that we're out here taking these risks. I just worry that if we wage war by remote too much, it not only dehumanizes it, but it also that there's no sort of check to make sure that the cause of the war is a just cause.
Yeah, and that's my take as well, Zachary. And just to reiterate, I am not in any way saying that, and I think I've got friends in the military, family that have served in the military, and we're, as a matter of fact, in my family, we're very, very proud of our long, rich history in the military. And
yeah, I'm the exception in my family. Almost everyone before me was in the military, and I just happened not to go that path.
Yeah. And so I, you know, in no way do I want to come across as criticizing or saying that, you know, warfare by drone is any less taxing to a person who may be operating that drone or offering support services. But
I'm the Wesley Crusher of my family. I ascended to a higher plane of existence and didn't enlist.
Like you, Zachary, I have this concern that somehow that human factor is removed from it when it becomes drone warfare. For instance, I'm no stranger to gaming, and I got in, logged in a couple of hours on Star Trek Online the other day. I killed some Klingons. It was
you
great.
Pulled the trigger on the phaser? You didn't hesitate to fire the phasers?
I did not hesitate. I said killed a few Klingons, and in truth, it was some Romulans. I was literally in a deal with some Romulans, but I'm disconnected from that personally.
This is a great example because the positive virtues that we associate with war, things like heroism, sacrifice, nobility, you could probably name a few others. I wouldn't call your firing the phasers in Star Trek Online any one of those things.
Exactly. And yet, drone warfare, I think there is a danger there that it can become very much that. I think about the guy who's maybe operating the controls of a drone, or guys, plural, gals, whomever, operating the controls.
I think I'd trust the gals to do that more than the guys.
No doubt. But they're just simply receiving an order. Here's a building. It's full of bad guys. Need you to fly the drone in. You're gonna drop a couple bunker busters on it and get out. First of all, there's no personal risk to anybody involved because they're doing it by remote. They're using a device. And yeah, if the device is lost, it's a few million bucks. It sucks, but you know, life goes on. However, for the people inside that bunker, as the person operating that drone, you're only going on, you know, what you're being told. So it does seem to me like it could be a little less human, a little less.
I mean, the obvious difference between what we're describing now and what we're seeing in the Arsenal of Freedom is that in the Arsenal of Freedom, it's not like the drones are being controlled by any intelligent, sentient beings, right? They're autonomous devices, as opposed to modern drone warfare, where there's still a human, presumably, or humans, controlling the devices by remote, more like playing a video game. But in the Arsenal of Freedom, the machines have become autonomous to the point where they've wiped out their own creators and they learn from their own mistakes and they keep improving, but they're not being controlled by some sentient, conscious, biological being in the Arsenal of Freedom, right?
Well, the weapon inside the Arsenal of Freedom has one objective, and that really is to destroy. And so it has no means of making a determination between friend or foe. So it did wipe out its own creator. And here inside this episode, it can't distinguish the customer from an enemy. I mean, if you think about it, this is like the worst customer service ever. I mean, it's literally firing on, it's obliterating its customer. I mean, I've had some bad customer service experiences, Zachary, but I got to say, this would be the worst. God help them if they decide to return it.
Yeah, you mean you haven't been fired upon when you're trying to return your merchandise at the local shopping establishment? So, Mike, another aspect of this episode that I wanted to talk about was this idea. In fact, it's a phrase from the episode, freedom through superior firepower. That's the slogan, if you will, of the Minos people, the Minos corporation that's selling these devices. And in my mind, again, I keep going back to the 80s because that's the era I grew up in. And that's when this episode arose. And that's what's going on in politically in the 80s, right? We were in a Cold War with the Soviet Union, and we were going to maintain our freedom by maintaining the bigger arsenal, knowing that mm-hmm. we could take them out instead of them taking us out if push came to shove. And that was, in 80s speak, our way of ensuring our way of life and ensuring our freedom, no matter what the Soviet Union could throw at us. What do we think of that as a virtue? And I think some people really took this to heart. They said, this is how you maintain freedom, through a superior arsenal. And that is what it means to be a free, just society. So if you have a free democratic society, ipso facto, that means you have to have the arsenal to prove it. Otherwise, you're constantly at danger of another world power taking you out. And that's what it means. I think other people have kind of toned that down a notch and said, well, yes, maybe, but we don't like that. We don't think of that as a virtue. And that might be the actual reality of the situation, that in order to maintain our way of life, we have to maintain a defense at a superior level. That might just be a brute force fact of our global nation state based world. But it's a question of virtues. Is that a good thing? Is that something we should embrace as a way of life, as a way of thinking about who we are as a people and what we need to create? Or do we recognize that that's a practical trade-off that we're not happy with from a virtue standpoint, but we do anyway for the sake of our own self-preservation?
Well, Zachary, I think that's so relevant to the times that we're living in. I think we have dialed back a little bit on the superior firepower rhetoric. But
well, we don't need Star Wars anymore.
Yeah, but I really don't see that mentality ever really going away. I think that there's always going to be a desire, as long as we're divided as nation states here on planet Earth, I think there will always be a desire to maintain an arsenal that is able to defend. And so I never see that really changing. Being realistic.
I want to reframe that in a slightly different way, though, because I think some would claim that this is an innate right of a nation state, that for any given group of people that have a political organization approaching the scale of a nation state, that they have the innate right to defend themselves. We think about that way about ourselves as the United States, right? We're good people. Sure. We have a right to defend ourselves. So we just happen to be in a position to put together the superior arsenal based on our superior resources here in the United States. But we don't tend to think that about other nation states. I'm thinking of the ones that are causing problems in the world today, whether it's Iran or whether it's North Korea. We don't tend to grant those people the right to put together the superior arsenal based on their status as a nation state. So in other words, we like being top dog and we don't like other people being top dog. And that's how we think of ourselves as here in the United States, I think. And I think we don't like granting that status to any other nation state, even nation states we happen to be friends with.
Well, I think we can even drill down a little bit further, on a more street level, concept of this problem, and that is, the Second Amendment debates that are very much alive and well here in the United States, and what are the limitations to the rights of citizens, individuals, to defend themselves? What is reasonable when it comes to the number and type of weapons that an individual can and should possess? And so these questions that we're asking here on MetaTracks, these are being debated certainly at the national and international level, but they're also being debated, on Main Street, here locally.
Well, Mike, they're certainly not going to allow the type of autonomous machine learning drone warfare devices that you see in this episode. Wouldn't it be interesting if everyone had one of those as a sidearm? You didn't even have to draw your sidearm. You just send your drone out. Like, get those kids off my lawn. Go, autonomous device.
And if that don't work 12 minutes later, you'll have an even better one.
Like, well, that technique didn't work. Those kids are still out there. All right, here comes round two.
Those little brats have 12 minutes, exactly, to get off my lawn.
This is the degeneration of civilized suburban living before our very eyes.
I think what's really unique in this episode is you said that the overall theme is...
Mike, in the episode, I believe it's peace through superior firepower.
Yeah, so if that's the overall theme of this episode, I think the point that's being made by the writers and creators here is that peace can actually be achieved through superior thought, through superior reason. And I think there's something to be said for that inside this episode, because despite the ability of this Minos device to replicate bigger and better, stronger, faster, it's adaptive, I think in spite of that, it lacks the ability to think, to reason in any way that is meaningful. And so I think the point here in this episode is that peace can be achieved through superior intelligence, through superior reasoning.
Well, Captain Picard does figure out basically how to turn the thing off, almost like Michael Burnham inside Discovery, figuring out how to talk her way out of the brig by, reasoning with the computer. Captain Picard essentially reasons with the autonomous computer and ultimately figures out that he can just say, "I'll take one," and turn the whole thing off.
Yeah, except
he outsmarts the machine.
Yeah, doesn't except- he?
I guess you can't just agree to buy the real deal. Like, if you're actually in a war with these devices, you can't just say, I'll take one of you and war's over. But this is essentially what goes on in war, right? War is a degeneration of our rational faculties, our ability to solve problems together as people, right? So the Star Trek view of this is that we can rise above that, we can come together as people, and we can say, let's talk our way out of this situation rather than continue to shoot at each other. And, you know, that rationality can raise the level of dialogue and can elevate us above the need for war. That's the Star Trek take on this, I really think. Even though, again, as Captain Janeway would say, she carries a big stick, right? But that's not the Star Trek view. The Star Trek view is we don't want to do that. We're going to find a way to talk our way out of the situation. We're going to come together as people and solve our problems and maybe learn from each other in the process. So I think of this episode more as a negative commentary on that kind of warfare thing. You know, I mean, you could arguably say that this episode is promoting freedom through superior firepower, peace through superior firepower, right? That was a reality in the 80s. Some people still think that way. It might be a practical or pragmatic reality, but that's not Star Trek's take. Star Trek's take is that is a degeneration of the best versions of ourselves that we can
precisely.
Be and that we can use our reason to rise above the need to function at that level.
Oh, precisely. I couldn't agree more. This is definitely a negative commentary towards that way of thinking. And that was the prevailing way of thinking. I think anybody who was alive and at any age to really gauge what was going on in society around them. And I'm not saying anything necessarily negative. And for those of you who have nostalgic feelings about the 80s, I'm right there with you, but
Mike, how many times have we heard Captain Picard say, let's see what match they are for the flagship of the Federation? That's essentially the same kind of thinking. We have the bigger stick and we're going to use it for good.
Well, and isn't that true of Star Trek as a whole in general? I mean, you know, my goodness, we continue to crank out bigger, better, faster. You know, in the 1960s, Star Trek gave us the NCC 1701. You know, it's Warp 7. It's a bigger ship than its predecessors, that Constitution class. And then they gave us the
Excelsior class.
And then they gave us the Excelsior class. And, you know, then there, you know, so on. On and so forth. Then we come to the Galaxy class that's bigger and
the
faster.
Ship to end all wars.
And we still, we're just making them bigger. And even when we get to the Kelvin timeline, I mean, my gosh, you know, the Enterprise in that episode is bigger than anything that we got in the Prime universe. It's just this idea of bigger, faster, stronger. We build these fleets, we build them big, we build them strong, and that's, isn't that sort of the whole thing about the Federation? We keep bringing these different species, these different worlds in. We're bigger and we're squeezing out the Romulans and we're squeezing out the Klingons and we're, you know, bring another one in. We'll make it bigger. We'll make it better. It's almost Borg-like when you think about it.
So, Mike, doesn't this seem just a little bit hypocritical? I mean, this is the naive view of Star Trek, right? Star Trek, oh, we're all pacifists and we're not going to, we can rise above war. But when push comes to shove, Captain Picard says, my ship is bigger than yours. So, Mike, are we making the Star Trek take on this to be too utopian or too idealistic? Are we not recognizing the, you know, implicit pragmatic need for this kind of thinking, even in an idyllic society like 24th century Federation society?
Well, I think it represents, Zachary, the reality that we're all flawed to some degree. Who needs a photon torpedo? We have quantum torpedoes. I mean, we're just going to make a better weapon. And, you know, who knows what we follow the quantum torpedo with, but I'm sure it's going to be a stronger, badder, greater weapon.
I guess that's my point. If the Klingons come up with a new kind of weapon, we're going to try to come up with a bigger one. If the Cardassians come up with a new kind of weapon, we're going to try to come up with a bigger one. And the Federation has the resources to do it. Moreover, the Federation thinks it's justified in doing that.
Well, and then in the midst of all of this, we have Section 31 that are developing weapons preemptively, and
Same difference, bigger stick, right?
There's a hypocrisy there. And we do it under the guise of, you know, we use our weapons, you know, for defensive purposes only. That's always what they say. Well, what's that you're carrying on your side there? Oh, that's a phaser. It's, you know, for defense only. Oh, really? Then why is there a kill switch on
that's,
it?
That's my personal Minos drone. Don't mess with it.
And in reality, I think that reflects a real flaw in us as human beings. I mean, we can sit here and be self-righteous. And I just say, you know, one nation state, and I can pick on anybody. I could say the United States or any other, you know, superpower out there. And I think that this is applicable. It's very easy for us to sit back and in a very self-righteous way, say, we're only trying to defend ourselves. But then when another nation begins to develop weapons, we say, oh, well, they're a threat to national, international security. And don't get me wrong, I recognize that there are regimes out there who it's probably best that they not have superior firepower. However, how self-righteous do you get until you come to the point to where you become suppressive, oppressive, whatever?
Well, I guess that's my point. You can kind of step back from the entire situation. We've been looking at this entire situation from a first-person standpoint, right? We view ourselves as having this innate right to defend ourselves, so we're going to keep coming up with bigger and bigger weapons, whether they're drones or whether they're missiles or whatever they are, to defend our status in the world and as people, right? But you can step back from that first-person perspective and take the third-person perspective. What kinds of devices and who is allowed to have them that genuinely promotes the greater good for the greater number of people in some utilitarian sense and minimizes harm and risk to some number of people in some utilitarian sense, right? So you can, I think you can. You can look at some countries in the world and go, yes, if they have these kinds of devices, that's really dangerous and bad and increases the risk and the dangers to some, you know, large number of people. So from a utilitarian standpoint, we just decide that they're not allowed to have them. And that factor outweighs any kind of innate right that they have to their own self-defense from a first-person standpoint.
Absolutely. And yet the Ferengi in me says, it's all good because either way I'll make a profit. I mean, war is good for business. Peace is good for business. I'm going to make a profit either way.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I do think one of the really interesting aspects of this episode is this commodification of war, the war business, the war industry that the people of Minos, such as they were in the war business, just like the Ferengi are in the arms business. I guess the question I have, and I'm going to ask this in a very broad general way because I'm not sure I really know exactly what I want to ask. I just want to, maybe we can drill down a little bit and see if we can get to a tighter question. But what does it mean to run an ethical arms business? In this episode, the Arsenal of Freedom, they kind of laugh at the Minos people at the beginning of the episode that they're willing to, you know, sell arms to anyone, which, you know, I forget who asked the question in the episode, but one character asks, who do they sell the weapons to, one side or the other? And Data says, both. And they have a little kind of, they have a little original series era chuckle about that on the bridge, right? Oh, yes, they're in the war business. They sell arms to anyone who will buy them. Okay, we understand that. And the Ferengi were like that later in TNG, and especially in Deep Space Nine. But what does it mean to run an ethical arms business? You know, is there something morally repugnant or vulgar about selling your weapons to anyone who will buy them?
I have it from a good source, Zachary, that the people of Minos actually recorded the training videos that they use to teach Ferengis sales and business ethics.
The feel, felt, found technique? Many of our clients felt that blah, 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 but they found that if they bought our weapons, they were able to achieve genuine peace and freedom through superior firepower. Sign on the dotted line, please.
Exactly. Exactly.
So I guess that's my question. Is there something inherently morally repugnant? Again, I'm going to ask this in a very pointed way, in a way that's probably not fair to people who are actually in the arms business, but is there something morally repugnant in general about the arms business? You make weapons that you know will be used to kill other people, and that is your business model, how you make your livelihood. What does it mean for that to be a respectable business? I don't have a good answer to that off the top of my head because I don't know enough about the industry.
Yeah, and I don't think there is a good answer to that because in reality, I think as long as we have these primal instincts to
wage war. Hey, speak for yourself. I've risen above it. Thank you.
Yeah. But I think as long as we have these primal instincts to wage war.
Tell the kids to get on my lawn.
I think that there will always be someone out there to profit from it. And in reality, the weapon is going to get made. It's going to be built. They're going to be sold. Somebody's going to make a profit. Is it repugnant? Well, you know, I put myself into the mindset of someone who maybe owns a gun company. You know, that Mike's Guns and Ammo.
Quark would say everyone's got to make a living, right?
Well, everyone's got to make a living, but here's the reality. I can look at this one of two ways. I can say, listen, I manufacture and sell defense for people.
Security.
I enable people to defend themselves.
Security, and peace.
That's noble. Stability. That's good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, on the same hand, do my weapons sometimes fall into the hands of bad people? Sure they do. That's the debate that's going on in our world today. We're having these conversations in the world today, and I think every CEO of every gun company, I think even companies like Lockheed Martin and Boeing, I think they're all having these kinds of moral and ethical debates that go on occasionally in their boardrooms when they develop these technologies and tools that can be used to wage war.
You know, the kind of propaganda that the cigarette industry and tobacco industry would use, you know, I'm thinking 20 or 30 years ago, a lot of that's kind of wound down because they've been regulated and they're not allowed to do that kind of propaganda in popular media these days, like they were able to in the 70s and 80s. But, I'm just wondering if the kinds of terminology you were just using, words like peace, security, safety, fill in the blank, right? These kind of positive connotation words, are those substantively different from the dangers of those devices, or are they more like sophistry and rhetoric and propaganda? Is there a genuine substantive difference? Like, these devices can be used to create stability and peace and security for you and your loved ones and your community and your nation, right? And the world. Or is that rhetoric a kind of smoke and mirrors to distract from, is it a distraction, a deflection from the dangers of these devices and the harm they cause? To ask the really pointed question, you know, is that substantive language, or is that, pardon the popular parlance, BS? And you can ask the same question about the people of Minos in the Arsenal of Freedom. Do they genuinely create peace and security through superior firepower? Are they a force for good in the galaxy? Have they ended wars, or are they profiting from the continuation of war? I think you can ask the same exact question about, you know, whether we're talking about handheld firearms here in the real world, whether we're talking about the arms industry for nation states, or the people of Minos in the Arsenal of Freedom.
I think within the episode, the people of Minos were painted in such a way that they were a people who were very short-sighted. I mean, the peddler inside the episode says, you know, perfection and highly advanced weaponry, versatility, flexibility, and everything 100%
he's so
guaranteed.
Proud of it.
Very proud and very naive as well. Perfection and highly advanced weaponry. I think to a great degree they had drank the Kool-Aid, Zachary, without considering the potential dangers of having such an adaptive weapon.
Too impressed with their own creation. To you, like the Tower of Babel, to use your mm-hmm. you know, a metaphor you'll find enticing. Right?
Yeah,
you can be so impressed with your own abilities, your own creation, that you forget the short-sightedness and the dangers of what you're doing.
And I think that's a great analogy, but I also believe that you've hit the nail on the head in that I think that there's a danger, even with non-weaponized technologies, I think that there's a danger of being very short-sighted and becoming too impressed with our ability to create technology that we're not stopping to consider the ramifications of what that technology means and how that technology can be used. I certainly don't believe that the people of Minos were so incredibly foolish that they would have purposely created a technology, a weapon that could destroy their entire planet, that could wipe them, literally, you know, commit genocide against them and wipe them out.
They had to have seen they had to have seen the danger involved. Maybe they didn't. Maybe this is just outright commentary on our own short-sightedness, and we're reading too many other issues into the episode. But
well, it's, you know, it's for instance, it's like asking the question, you know, were the people primarily responsible for giving us the internet? You know, were they aware at the time when they first began to conceive and develop the technologies involved in making the internet a possibility? Did they ever stop to consider how a bad guy might be able to use that technology to steal somebody's identity?
No, I think that the new technology at the time is, it almost always has this kind of utopian promise to it, right? This technology will solve all our problems, and we're blind to the dangers and the you know, harmful consequences that are hard to foresee that will inevitably come.
And I think perhaps that may be what happened to the people of Minos. I think they really did buy into that idea that, you know, peace can be achieved through superior firepower. I think they genuinely believed that pitch. I don't think that they ever stopped to consider the potential risks involved in developing a weapon that is adaptive and self-replicating.
Well, with any new technology, whether it's a communication technology like the internet, or whether it's weapons technology like drones or like Star Wars in the 80s, or whether it's war by remote control in the 90s in the Gulf War, or whatever we have nowadays that I don't know about, right? Whatever it is, I guess there's a fundamental question you can ask about it from a value standpoint. Is technology morally neutral? Is it purely a non-value-laden tool, and it's up to the humans to impose value on that tool based on how it's used, right? Whether it's a firearm, if it's used for good or used for evil. Whether it's a weapon that a nation state has, is it used for good, self-defense, or is it used for evil to wage war? With the internet, you know, it can be used in some utopian sense, spreading the free access of information, or it can be used for surveillance, right? So there's, you know, any technology kind of has a great way of using it and a bad way of using it. Does that mean the technology itself is morally neutral, or are the benefits and the dangers kind of implicit in the nature of the technology itself? The mere fact that someone develops, say, let's pick your favorite weapon of mass destruction, right? So someone who develops a weapon of mass destruction, is that inherently morally problematic because of its nature as a weapon of mass destruction, with that thing that we have this word for, a term, a label, WMD, weapon of mass destruction? Does that impose this value, this negative value connotation, into the object itself, right? Is there something inherently morally wrong about that? Or is it just a tool like any other tool? It can be used for good or it can be used for evil, depending on who uses it in what way. Which way is the right way of reading technology? Is technology implicitly morally laden with all of its connotations and consequences and virtues and dangers? Or are these objects we're describing, any piece of technology, weapons or otherwise, mere objects with no values whatsoever until humans decide what to do with them?
I think that's an excellent question.
That's the heart of the issue, right? I mean,
it really is. It really is the heart of the issue. And it's a $64,000 question, I think what we're talking about here. You know, we're talking about a technology that is adaptive, it is self-replicating, there is an element of AI to it, of artificial intelligence, but it doesn't possess any sense of morality, Zachary. It's very similar to a drone, that it really depends on the person who is operating the controls. I mean, that drone can fire on bad guys as well as it can fire on the good guys. It just depends on the person who's sitting at the controls. The difference here is that this technology possessed artificial intelligence and no moral compass for which to guide it.
Well, Is it a question of scale? Like, let me run this reasoning by you. In the Star Trek universe, if you have, say, a small personal phaser, like they're little mini phasers you get in TNG, right? Not even the big ones, the little mini phasers. I forget which type they are, but, you know, type one, what's called a type one phaser. You know, it might be the wrong number, but the mini ones. You know, that is arguably just a tool. It can be used for good. It can be used for evil. It's just a thing. I think that's very plausible when you're talking about a small personal device like that, right? As you get progressively bigger in scale in terms of effects. What about the bigger phasers, the Type 2 phasers? What about
phaser rifles?
What about the phaser rifles? Okay, let's bump it up a notch from there. What about a phaser on a ship? You know, not a personal phaser, but a big phaser. What about a photon torpedo? What about a quantum torpedo? What about the kind of device that you see in Star Trek Generations that can in nuclear fusion inside of a star, right? Those, you know, there's this question of scale there. And I think when you're at the bottom end of the scale, I think it's very easy to say, this is just a thing. It's just a tool like any other tool. It's a screwdriver, right? You can use it for good. You can use it for evil. Depends on the person. But as you get progressively bigger in scale, the dangers get greater and greater and greater to the point where you can plausibly say, I think the danger of these kinds of devices is so great that the negative connotation, the negative value or moral connotation is implicit in the object itself because that danger is inherent in the object. I think the dangers inherent to a personal Type 1 phaser in Star Trek are pretty small, right? Because you can get taken out by a phaser rifle or you can get beamed off the ship. And there's only so much damage you can do with a little tiny phaser rifle like that, right? But as you get bigger and bigger in scale, the risks inherent in that object get greater. So is it possible to say that when you move up a level or two or three in scale, that the values, I'm thinking of the negative values of the dangers of weapons in this case, do those values get embedded in the object somehow to the point where we can't plausibly say they're a mere tool anymore? And I think that's plausible as you get bigger and bigger in scale in terms of the dangers of weaponry.
I think it comes back to the idea of the intelligence that was within it. There was an intelligence, but it lacked the moral compass.
That's not even intelligent. I think in the Arsenal of Freedom, I think of those drones as not even being intelligent in some artificially intelligent sense. I think of them just being more like, you know, like those dumb kind of machine learning algorithms that you can teach to play video games.
Yeah.
You know, they run through it once and they make some mistakes. They run through it again, they make different mistakes. You know, on time number 47, you know, they manage to hit something that works and they go, okay, I've got a little farther in the game this time. So now I know what to do. The algorithm doesn't say to itself, it gets modified based on you know, fairly random tweaks to the program, as I understand how these machine learning algorithms work. But there's no self-awareness. There's no consciousness to it, right? There's no intelligence per se. The algorithms do get better in terms of their effect, but they're not conscious. I think of that as what's going on in the Arsenal of Freedom, that through trial and error, these drone devices try things that work or fail to various degrees. If something fails, they try something else. If that fails, they try something else. And they combine a progressive increase in scale in terms of scope of what the devices can do with more sophisticated mechanics based on what the algorithms have learned, in irony quotes, because I don't think there's any intelligence there, but what the algorithms have figured out works and doesn't work in terms of previous attempts, combine that together and they get something that's more effective in the next pass. But I don't think of the machines as being actually artificially intelligent in a Terminator-like sense.
Yeah, I agree. I certainly agree. I had a program back in the early 90s. It was a chess and checkers program.
It's a chess program. Yes.
Yeah, it was a chess program. Exactly. And it learned from failure. The first time I ever played it, I beat it. The second time, it was a little tougher. The third time, even harder than that. But eventually, the program became intelligent enough to anticipate what I would do, and it learned to beat me. However, by modifying the way that I played, I could get back in the driver's seat and beat the program again. But again, it's going to continue to learn. It's going to continue to grow until it beats me. And I'm not a great player. So then perhaps somebody who is a good player could sit down and play it and beat it very easily. But it's going to get more and more difficult. If I were to get, say, the best chess player that ever lived to sit down and play the thing, yeah, probably beat it a couple times. But eventually, you know, it would adapt and grow. And I think that's very much, you know, what we're seeing here.
So, Mike, the kind of thing you're describing in a chess algorithm is the kind of thing I'm thinking is going on here, but at a slightly larger scale. I recently came across this YouTube video where a computer program had been created to teach itself to play Super Mario Brothers, the Nintendo game from the 80s, speaking of the 80s. And it runs through hundreds of attempts to learn to play Super Mario Brothers, because Super Mario Brothers is a complicated game. You have to run at certain speeds, not hit certain objects, jump in certain places, not fall into the pits. There's a lot of things you have to take into account, and our brains do it really, really well, right? We learn very quickly. But imagine how, like, a three-year-old learns to play Super Mario Brothers. You grab the controls, and you run, and you hit a Koopa Trooper, and you die, right? And then you run, and you figure out, finally, you know the first level of Super Mario Brothers, how there's all these little objects in your place designed to teach you how to play the game? You know what I'm talking about. You've played it, right?
Yeah.
You run and then you hit an enemy and you die. So you quickly learn, oh, I have to jump here. And, you know, that's how it teaches you how to jump. And then there's an object in your way. And so you have to learn to jump over the object. And then there's these tantalizing little question blocks that you have to hit. And if you hit one of those when you jump, you get a little reward, you know, a little positive reinforcement. You get a little mushroom. And then when you finally run into the mushroom, you realize it turns you into Super Mario and you get to have these extra powers. You get to be bigger, jump a little higher, and eventually you can throw fireballs, and that's how you learn to play Super Mario Brothers. But it's very much trial and error.
And pretty soon you become plugged into the Spore Drive, and oh, that's something else. You said mushrooms, and I digress.
After 130 jumps, you end up... of the Spore Drive. So that's actually what's going on in Discovery. I figured out they're teaching Stamets to play Super Mario Brothers.
Mystery solved.
Boom! That's my new Discovery theory. They're actually machine learning Super Mario Brothers. But so this computer program essentially does that. It runs through permutation after permutation after permutation playing Super Mario Brothers, trying to get as far in the game as possible. And it just tries things at random. You know, some attempts will be successful. Some attempts will not be successful. Sometimes it'll jump randomly in certain places and that won't work. Sometimes the random jumps will result in jumping over an enemy and you'll get a little further in the game. And after hundreds or thousands of attempts, the computer program can essentially beat a level of Super Mario Brothers, never having been programmed to actually do that thing, because the algorithms are adjusting themselves based on some criterion, and the criterion would be something like get as far as possible in the level, either maximize the points or maximize the distance or some criterion that's specified beforehand. But the actual mechanics of playing the game are discovered through a very complex system of trial and error. I think of that as what's going on inside the arsenal of freedom, right? These devices start out kind of stupid. They try a couple things that aren't very effective. They're easy to defeat. And then the next attempt is a permutation on that previous attempt, either a random introduction of some new element or an increase in scale based on what it learned from a previous attempt. But I don't think that the algorithm, in this case, it's called MARIO. It's very cute. MARI/O, like Mario input out, but it's very cute.
Nice.
And just to drop a reference here, the person who posted this video on YouTube is called Seth Bling. So if you want to check out the video, search for MARIO and Seth Bling and check out this video. It's really interesting to see a computer program learn to play Super Mario Brothers. But I think of that as what's going on in this episode. I don't think of this computer program, MARIO, as being intelligent in any way, shape, or form. It's not conscious. It's not aware. It's not making decisions per se. But it does get progressively better and better based on trial and error. And again, learning in irony quotes from previous attempts. That's what's going on with these drone devices, right? They're not conscious of what they're doing. They're not making choices based on the morality of the situation. They're merely trying to achieve some specified goal, defeat the enemy, and they're trying permutation after permutation after permutation until that goal is achieved. So again, the fundamental question is, are these devices morally neutral? Because they're not conscious. They're not... They're just a tool. They can be used for good or evil. Depends on how they're programmed and what their objective is. And it's up to the people who are in control of them, or lack of control in this case, who should have been in control of them, to decide what their purpose is and what their objective is, and to imbue them with some value ladenness. Or are the dangers of these kinds of self-intelligent, machine learning devices so great past a certain point in scale, when the dangers get so great, that we can't plausibly say they're a mere tool with no values laden in them anymore? I think it's a really interesting question, but in my mind, I just think it's more plausible that as you get a progressive increase in scale and in danger, specifically talking about weaponry here in the Arsenal of Freedom, that past a certain point, these objects can't be mere tools anymore because the dangers are so great that we can't help but associate the risk implicitly and necessarily associate the risks of those devices with the devices themselves.
Yeah, I think they are morally neutral, at least in the episode. I think that's reasonably well established. They're morally neutral. However, they're extremely flawed in that while they have this algorithm that obviously gives them the ability to adapt and improve, unfortunately, they don't have any means to distinguish between friend or foe, customer or enemy. And so obviously that's a real life danger. I think, Zachary, as you give autonomous adaptability to any type of machine, there is a danger that autonomous adaptability becomes a liability that can turn deadly.
Yeah, but I guess, I want to press you on this because I think it's not really plausible that these are mere tools, right? Whether in the episode or here in the real world. Like, suppose I took this Mario program that I was just describing to play Super Mario Brothers. And if you're just talking about a self-contained Mario, let's learn to play Super Mario Brothers kind of environment, there's no risk involved, right? This thing can run until the cows come home and there's no danger to it. So, again, morally neutral, no values associated with it whatsoever. It's just a thing. It's kind of an interesting thing. You should go check it out. But now let's suppose I describe a slightly different situation. Suppose this Mario program is hooked up to a Schrodinger's cat device. And when the objective is met, the thing gets triggered and the cat gets let out of the proverbial Schrodinger's cat bag, for lack of a better word. And that Schrodinger's cat device is hooked up to a nuclear device in New York City. So when the objective is met, some really disastrous consequence is going to happen. Can we look at that Mario program anymore and just say, that's just a thing. It's just harmless. There's no morality associated with it whatsoever. I think once the consequences come into play, once you realize there are disastrous consequences associated with the thing, you can't plausibly say that's just a thing with no values anymore. You would look at that program and go, yeah, that's dangerous. We need to control that now. That's not something we want out there for public consumption, given that it's a trigger for some disastrous device. I think you can look at the devices in the Arsenal of Freedom and say the same kind of thing. They start out seeming kind of innocuous, right? They don't seem to have much firepower and boom, boom, boom. And it's more like a little chess game. But once you realize they're deadly and they have the power to kill 1,000 people on a starship, it's the same device. It's working on the same principles, but the stakes have become so high, it's not a mere tool anymore.
Yeah, I follow your reasoning. However, I associate that with an inherent flaw in the design.
There should be a Schrodinger's cat failsafe, is what you're saying.
And I think the failsafe has to be someone who has the ability to control that, who has the ability to make moral and ethical decisions.
Well, that's why in our, presumably, again, I don't really know how these things work, but you see, characters of this kind of thing where, like, there's the people with the nuclear codes and there's the two people who have to turn their keys simultaneously to launch the nuclear missiles, right? That kind of thing is this human check on the danger of these devices, right? Mm-hmm. We don't just leave it to automation. We don't just leave it to the computer program. We don't leave it to our own technological creativity. At a certain point for our deadliest devices, real humans have to be the ones that turn the keys. That's how I kind of envision it. In my stereotypical caricature kind of way.
You know, it's really interesting, Zachary, because we've seen these kinds of real-world scenarios play out with modern technology associated with the weapons that we use in warfare. We have had real-world accidents where technology broke down. It wasn't a human error. It wasn't, some human failing. It was a failing of technology. I think about the tragedy that took place a couple of years ago that involved this international incident between the United States and Canada. I mean, Canadian military members died because of a technological breakdown. There, the multinational investigation discovered that it was not a human failing at all. It was a glitch in technology that caused a weapon to be fired against members of the Canadian military.
Well, I think that's all the reason why for our deadliest kind of devices, we don't just leave it to pure automation. Although, you know, and we live in a 21st century society now. This is 30 years after this episode came out. Mm-hmm. Look how much is automated. So many things in my house and in the community around me and in our country and in the world are automated. And, you know, plausible. I think you say the right thing. You know, that technology could break. I mean, well-designed technology shouldn't break. There should be fail-safes or redundancies or whatever to prevent the technology from breaking. But I think this is the reason why we would want a human check on our deadliest kind of devices with the biggest consequences.
Yeah, I agree. And to my point, I hope that out of that, we're able to learn a very valuable lesson. And I think that lesson needs to be that automation and that kind of ability do not go hand in hand. I think, and I don't want to sound like someone who is suffering from technophobia, because anyone who knows me well knows that I love my technology. I love my computer, my dual monitors, and my smartphone, and my iPad, and I've got a car with lots of cool gadgets and technologies in it, and I like technology, but I'm very wary of automation and technology. I think there's a danger here. You know, we're talking about, you know, within the next 10 to 20 years, and we're experimenting with them now. I mean, I don't even think it's 10 years down the road. I think it's much sooner than that. We're gonna have cars that drive themselves. I mean, I can really foresee an Uber being automated in the next 5 years. I don't think that's so far. You know, we were talking 10, 20 years. I don't think it's that far into the future. We have the ability to automate our homes, to turn our furnaces on and our air conditioning, and do all of that in a very automated way. And I think there's a danger when we relinquish that much control to automation. I can really see the military developing drones that no longer need a human pilot. I mean, we have that technology. It exists now. But if I can do a little PSA here for a moment, I think we really need to step back as a society and say, hey, are we really ready for that? Because once we relinquish control and we take away the human component from things like driving an automobile or flying a plane, and progress that as far as you want to, I think we run the danger of having something happen like we see here inside the Arsenal of Freedom in TNG's first season.
I see what you're saying from a practical standpoint, that we want to make this qualitative distinction between human control and human experience overseeing the technology and mere automation. Where I think the line gets blurry is in these kinds of machine learning environments compared to how our own brains actually work. And I think this is what's interesting and promising and scary about this idea of artificial neural networks at the same time, that this kind of process, that this MAR-IO program, trial and error, modifying algorithms to achieve certain goals, sounds very kind of dumb and artificial in an isolated standpoint, but that's also how our brains actually do learn. And I think that's why there's so much emphasis being put on this kind of machine learning research right now, because there seems to be at least a structural, functional parallel between how our brains actually learn. The way a three-year-old learns to play Super Mario Brothers is essentially the same thing that this computer program is doing, making mistakes, learning from those, trying something different, trying to get a little further in the game. And by extension, all of life is like that for us. We have certain experiences, certain goals in mind. We try certain things, run into dead ends, run into bad consequences here, try something a little different, modify this, all to achieve whatever our goals are. And that kind of subtle iterative modification of the again, maybe in irony quotes, algorithms that define how we go about trying to solve a problem and function in life is essentially how our brains work. That's how we solve problems. That's how we achieve goals. That's how we learn, right? And so whether the difference, of course, is that what we seem to have meaning and consciousness and we understand, and these computer programs like Mar.io or like these drones in the Arsenal of Freedom tend to be a little dumb, right? We don't think of them as being self-aware of what's going on, but structurally and functionally, it's the same basic approach. Let's try something. If that doesn't work, let's try something a little different. Let's learn from our mistakes, try something a little different, all trying to achieve whatever the goal is. And there's a structural similarity there. So it's very easy to draw this kind of semi-plausible qualitative distinction between the human touch and human consciousness and human oversight and dumb algorithms that don't know what they're doing, right? Mere automation in the self-driving Uber car sense, or chess programs, or Mar.io, or whatever it is, right? But in reality, there's a lot more similarity there than we would like to say there is.
I think there's a very thin line that separates those two things.
That's my point exactly, that you can't draw a nice, tidy dividing line between the human approach to learning and knowledge and oversight and machine learning and modification and trial and error based on these machine learning neural network algorithms. Structurally, they function very, very similarly. Ours is more complicated, right? You know, we take more into account in ours. But the structural approach to trying something, running into mistakes, trying something else until you get something right and learning from that and building on it, that's how we learn and that's how these machine algorithms learn. So yes, from a safety standpoint, you go, well, we can't trust our safety and nuclear devices and Uber cars and these high-risk devices to mere automation, but we can trust ourselves, even though we're often doing the same thing. We're doing trial and error. We're learning from our mistakes. We're building on past successes, and we're modifying things based on past failures. And once in a while, we're going to run into a wall. Once in a while, we're going to accidentally start a war. Once in a while, we're going to make a moral slip up, or once in a while, we're going to do whatever, right? We're no different than the algorithms in that situation. So it's not as easy to draw a neat and tidy dividing line between humans and machine in that sense from a structural standpoint. Well, Mike, we've kind of turned this episode every which way. We've talked about drone warfare. We've talked about peace or freedom through superior firepower. We've talked about machine learning, the difference between artificial intelligence and machine learning and neural networks. We've talked about the ethics of the war business and arms business. You know, war is good for business, as the Ferengi would say. We talked about that. The other thing I found really interesting about this episode, maybe not necessarily philosophically, but I would be remiss if I didn't talk about it, is how much of a badass Geordi is at handling his first command crisis, right? He gets to be in command, really, from what we can tell, maybe for the first time. That's the connotation I got from watching the episode. And he's got pressure from the chief engineer, you know, the sixth or eighth or ninth chief engineer we've seen in the first season of TNG to relinquish command because he's kind of a junior officer, and he's got this high risk situation. 1,000 lives are at risk on the Enterprise, and he's got the lives of the away team down there. They're fighting a war fighting a battle that they probably can't win because these devices keep rising to the occasion and besting the Enterprise. And I think the chief engineer is rightly saying, you know, I'm the senior officer. You need to relinquish command to me because Captain Picard didn't foresee the situation. I think Geordi handles the pressure like a badass. I think he handles the pressure from the chief engineer really well. He balances his responsibility to the 1,000 people on board with his responsibilities to the away team. And he makes the hard calls and is able to sit in the center seat and be a model of command presence, even amidst his own insecurities and fears. And he just does a really, really good job commanding the Enterprise for the first time in that situation. What do you think?
You know, I have been known to be a little critical of Geordi. He's not my favorite character in the Star Trek universe. I know I just got booed by probably half of our listeners, but Geordi to me is a little dramatic. He's a little touchy-feely, and I see a lot of that in this episode. I mean, him walking up and patting his helmsman on the shoulder, you know, your training. This is, you know, it's just a little too much for me.
You didn't buy his inspirational speech?
I didn't buy the inspirational speech. I didn't find it inspirational. I found it a little cheesy. And, you know, the personal contact there I thought was a bit much. But I do have to say that for a character who I feel has been very out of place this entire season. I'm really glad that they made him chief engineer because he needed more to do.
Yeah,
he needed more to do. I always felt that in the first season, he just seemed lost, out of place. He was a character with no real purpose inside the inside these episodes. But here, I can certainly see why eventually we made him, Captain LaForge. We see that command presence, and I think we see the beginnings of a very good senior officer. And I think it was a great episode for Geordi, but again, he's just a little too touchy-feely for my taste. He's not my favorite character, but this is a great episode for him.
I was trying to track the argument of the chief engineer, which is remarkably difficult to do because he's basically criticizing everything Geordi is doing.
Sure.
If he sends a rescue team to the planet to rescue the away team, then he's putting those people in danger. He's endangering the lives of 1,000 people in the Enterprise. He can't stay and fight a battle he can't win, so... And if Geordi orders the ship away from the away team stuck on the planet, then he's abandoning his responsibility to the away team. He's basically painted Geordi into quite a corner. There's no good resolution to the situation. And his answer to every single one of those options is, you need to relinquish command to me because I'm the senior officer. Even though any option Geordi picks, he's got something he can criticize about that option.
I find his willingness to put those 1,000 lives on the line to mount some futile rescue attempt, really disturbing. I mean, so much for the needs of the many outweighing the needs of the few. There's no Vulcan blood in this guy at all. And he's out of line on so many different levels. And honestly, I think one of the things that I really have to give props to Geordi for is that when he makes the decision to separate the two sections of the ship, he calls him up and puts him in command of the saucer section. And I got to be honest with you. I think that is real leadership right there, because oftentimes leaders will not utilize the skills, ability, and knowledge that their rivals have. And I think one of the marks of a real leader is to
get past all of
their personal feelings and put the mission first. And Geordi does that in this episode.
Well, they have to be a little careful from a dramatic standpoint, because separating the ship, that they established that in the very first episode of The Next Generation, that the ship can separate now. And in theory, the Constitution-class Enterprise could do that too, although we never saw that. But there's a couple of
references. In-universe.
In-universe, right, exactly. But we never actually saw it on screen. But they established in the first episode of The Next Generation, the ship can separate and you can protect a great number of these lives. Let's call it 700 or 800 lives that live in the saucer section that don't need to function in a battle. You can send them off to safety when the danger is too great, right? So you can't use that every episode because it means the stakes are lower, implicitly lower every single time you're in a crisis. Like, oh, the Klingons are here. Send the saucer section away while we fight the battle. You can't do that every episode, right? So they don't really ever establish why it's appropriate in some situations and why it's not appropriate in other situations. But from a utilitarian standpoint, if you can minimize the risk by, if you have 1,000 lives and that constitutes the sphere of people you're responsible for, and you can take 800 of them and send them off to safety while you have all the ability to deal with the crisis at hand with only 200 people, then you should do it. That's the right thing to do from a utilitarian standpoint. So I'm kind of surprised it doesn't come up more often in general from a utilitarian standpoint. Like, why don't they send more people to safety whenever they can, or when there's a crisis, why don't they beam the children down to a planet or something? Get all the civilians mm-hmm. out of there, insofar as civilians have to be there. And you can understand dramatically why they can't do that every episode. It's a distraction from the plot and it lowers the stakes dramatically, but they never satisfactorily explain why they don't do that more often. But I'm surprised that this isn't more of a go-to solution. Like, the ship can separate. We need to stay here and protect the away team. We need to fight this little battle with the drone devices, but let's separate the ship and get the saucer section out of there. Why is that such a surprising approach to a novel solution to the problem that Geordi comes up with? Everyone's like, hey, that's a pretty good idea, Geordi. Like, oh yeah, we just did that 8 episodes ago. Come on, guys.
For sure. I do have to say, though, Zachary, I've got to give a shout out to our friends over at Star Trek Continues. I made the point of saying in universe, in in prime Star Trek, that is, you know, the CBS's iteration of Star Trek, we never see the Constitution-class ship separate. Our friends over at Star Trek Continues just finished out their 11-episode continuation of the original 5-year mission. With their final episode, To Boldly Go, which is a 2-parter, we actually get to see the Constitution class separate. So if you want to see what that looks like, go over and check out To Boldly Go, parts 1 and 2 of Star Trek Continues. They did a fantastic job with that, and it's a great, great, great bridge between the original series and Star Trek the Motion Picture.
I think you just have to give Geordi some credit, because from all sides he's feeling an all or nothing solution. He either has to stay and fight and risk the 1,000 people on the ship, he can run away from the fight and abandon the away team, and there's no good solution. And he really does kind of take those two endpoints and find a good middle ground, like, oh, I can separate the ship and no one's thought of this, but I can get more people to safety and I can stay and protect the away team, and I can, you know, hash out the situation with the chief engineer, give him something to do to get him off my back, and I can stay in command because Captain Picard put me in command, and I can inspire my people with my little inspirational speech. And he does a great job putting all that together and finding an innovative solution in the moment, and that shows his kind of creative genius and problem solving. And so much of life is like that. We paint ourselves into little corners when really there's a middle ground or an outside the box solution. I just wanted to call attention to the fact that Geordi was pretty awesome at coming up with an innovative solution in the moment when he's got not only the danger of the situation, but he's got his on paper superior breathing down his neck, trying to get him to relinquish command. And he really owns the situation, and he's a model of inspiration.
Well, and again, we get to see him, and I think this really becomes kind of a theme in this episode. I think we get to see Geordi learn and adapt. I mean, he's had a couple failed attempts, and that's why he's getting pressure from the chief engineer.
You're saying he's Geordi-O?
He's Geordi-O. Speaking of learning and adapting, we get to see Captain Picard in the episode learn a little bit about outside-the-box medicine within the episode. When Dr. Crusher is injured, seriously injured, inside the episode, and there's no med kit readily available. There's no hypos to bail him out. No technology to make it easy.
Yeah, they could have been really fatalistic, like, no more med kit. Well, so much for us. Been nice knowing you, Dr. Crusher. But that's not what they do, right? That's not what Starfleet officers are supposed to do. But we do that so much in the real world. Like, oh, I can't do whatever because I don't have my whatever and I'm in this situation. And, well, put your thinking cap on and figure it out, or rely on some weird expertise or experience you've got to find an outside-the-box solution. We have great power to do that as creative beings, and we forget that sometimes.
I read, Zachary, that when this episode was originally conceived, that this was supposed to be a scenario that brought Picard and Crusher closer together. We get to develop their relationship, their personal relationship, a bit. It was supposed to be more of a romantic joining between the two, and I'm so glad they didn't do that. And I think what we got, I think, was something really interesting, that they were able to grow closer, but not in, you know, an intimate way, you know, a romantic way, but you know, a more intimate way in terms of their friendship, their respect for one another. I love the dialogue. Picard's learning about her. You know, she's not all about the technology. Which I think is in contrast to what's going on the surface with the drones. It is all about this adaptive technology. Well, here they're going old school. And yeah, we don't have a med kit. We don't have, you know, this technology. So what do we do? Well, you know what? There's some roots over there. What are those about? What do they look like? What do they taste like? And where did you learn this? Well, my grandmother. And so, you know, they're kind of going old school, and they're talking about holistic medicine and herbs. And I find that really to be a satisfying contrast to what's going on with this technological battle that's taking place above them.
Yeah, she's gone all Dr. Crusher medicine woman.
Such a minor but really, point, but that's perfect.
Well, okay, so insofar as this episode is a commentary on the dangers of technology and the danger of relying on technology and short-sighted thinking, this is kind of some esoteric knowledge that Dr. Crusher has. You know, she has kind of this herbalism. You know, it's not spooky and metaphysical, but it's not mainstream medicine either. It's sort of more holistic, which is debatable. Some people think there's real medicine there, and some people think it's a little, it's more, you're in the medical industry. What do people think of holistic medicine? People that either think it's great and it has real value, or it's some sort of charlatanism, right? It's a placebo effect, right? Doesn't actually do anything, some people think. I'm totally neutral on this. I don't know enough about it one way or the other. But she has some pretty esoteric knowledge that in the 24th century mainstream medicine seems to have forgotten or ignored. And Dr. Crusher has not let this go by the wayside. So she's made herself out to be massively useful because she hasn't overly relied on, pardon the phrase here, but technological medicine. She has a pre-technological medicine approach to this situation, and that manages to save their bacon.
Well, I think you captured the modern, at least in our own world, the modern attitudes, a couple of them at least, towards the different schools of thought in terms of medicine. There are people who are very much about emerging technologies in the medical field. And don't get me wrong, there are some wonderful technologies out there, I think, that have tremendous potential in terms of treating and even wiping out some of the diseases, ailments, problems that plague our society. I think that there's a lot of promise out there, but there are a lot of dangers as well, especially with pharmaceuticals, because of, you know, the potential side effects that exist when you introduce foreign chemicals into the body. And I think even the pharmaceutical companies are becoming more aware of that. And so what we're seeing today in our world is a throwback to sorts, a revisiting of some of these holistic methods and trying to determine which of them are legitimate, which of them hold the most promise. I think we're taking more of a holistic approach to medicine, and we are combining that holistic approach with these emerging technologies. And I think we're innovating in ways, as far as healthcare is concerned, I think we're innovating in ways that we have never been able to before, because we're able to legitimize what works and what does not. And we're able to isolate, you know, particularly what it is about this root or this herb that has the potential to treat or cure disease. And we're able to really enhance that ability. And we're seeing tremendous accomplishment in terms of medical research out there. So again, to see that inside this episode, again, I don't think we have to wait for the 23rd century. I think we're seeing it right now in our own world.
Well, certainly this is an amazing character moment between Captain Picard and Dr. Crusher, kind of cements their trust and friendship in a way that mm-hmm. maybe hasn't been before. They haven't been tested together like this necessarily. And I know I keep going back to the original writer's intentions in some hermeneutical sense, like, hey, I wonder if they really meant to put this connotation in there, because it's an interesting dovetail on the topic we were already talking about, like this danger of relying on technology, you know, the idea of losing control of our own technological creations is one of the themes of this episode that we've spent some time on. But there's a danger in over-relying on medical technology and losing touch with some things that were important in the past that may still have some value, that aren't culturally or scientifically the mainstream or the norm these days. And we see a nice little throwback to another way of doing medicine besides a technological way of doing medicine. And I think that's a nice parallel to what's going on with the main theme of the episode. It could be a happy accident, or it could be something that was written in intentionally for thematic effect, but I'm not really sure which it is. I don't know if you have any opinion on it. By no means are we bound by the writer's original intentions, but I do wonder whether this was intentional or a happy accident, and as Bob Ross would say.
No, that's the beauty of Star Trek. And I have to say that I don't think that it's a happy accident that we have a stark contrast with what's going on in these two plot lines. We have, you know, one plot line, it's very technologically driven. We have one subplot, B plot, if you will, that is driven by the lack of technology. I don't think that's an accident at all. And it's a really interesting contrast inside this episode. And I think, honestly, it's one of the things I think that makes it the type of episode that you can say, you know, there, I can very easily see this exact episode taking place in the original series universe.
Oh yeah, this is very much a, we observed this at the beginning of the episode, this is very much a TOS inspired concept for a story.
Except DeForest Kelly is by no means as good looking as Gates McFadden.
He might be better with herbalism though.
Maybe so. Maybe so.
Well, Mike, it's been fun talking about preserving the peace through superior firepower using our superior podcasting skills. But this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Primitive Culture, a look at history and culture through Star Trek.
Star Trek is more than just average television. I mean, I know I'm going to say that as a Trekkie fan. Everyone's like, yeah, of course you're going to say that. But Gene Roddenberry started out with a vision. He wanted to make television that broke barriers, was about social commentary, that got people to think, that widened people's minds. He didn't just want to make television that was financially successful.
Literary Treks.
I'm wondering if there's kind of a bit of a parallel there with Narinda and the totality not knowing what love is.
That's,
you know, they just need a certain song sung to them. I want to know what love is. Something like that. Anyway, there you go. That's all you're going to get out of me.
I was just waiting for that. I watched you hesitate, like, am I going to do this? And boom, you went there. I loved it.
Standard Orbit.
What lends credibility to all of this is these were concepts that came up from the writers at the time. It's not you and me saying, hey, what if we do this? What if we do that? Which I'm sure would be extraordinarily entertaining for our listeners. But, you know, when you're actually looking at things that, you know, were written out by the writers at the time, you see the similarities and you see the struggle with creativity in time.
Earl Grey.
You know, out of all this, I mean, you can see throughout the whole entire episode, you see the frustration that Data's going through, trying to go through these protocols that I'm sure he's going through, and then he has to actually choose some kind of violence in order to get his point across. Like, hey, you need to go.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all of these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on your iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, in most third-party podcast apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to mind meld with us. The best place to join in the larger conversation is in the Babel Conference, our listeners-only discussion group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the contact form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Just choose Message to a Trek FM Show and select MetaTreks. That will come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Well, Mike, speaking of contact information, when your neural network isn't learning from past mistakes, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, pretty much anytime you plug cmichael1701 into a social networking app, you'll find me. I'm on Facebook most often. I love to talk philosophy and Star Trek with you over on the Babel Conference, over on Twitter. My handle is at cmichael1701. I'm occasionally on Instagram. You can always catch my blog about my journey to publish my novel. That's cmichael1701.wordpress.com. And Zachary, when you're not cruising around the galaxy on the good ship Lollipop, where can our listeners find you around the interwebs and on the Trek FM network?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM's podcast dedicated to all things Star Trek Voyager, along with my two co-hosts over there, Kay Shaw and Suzanne Williamson. You can always find me in the Babel Conference if you'd like to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me over there. And you're welcome to follow me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. If you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, we invite you to become a patron of the network through Patreon. Just visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and many more, all available through our special patrons website, the Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of time and money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. Well, we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTrex team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, and the individual with the most developed neural network I know.
He's definitely the most adaptive.
Definitely, without a doubt. Our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Kenneth Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Brandon Che Mutala, our Patreon manager. And we'd like to give a special thank you and a shout out to our four associate producers here on MetaTrex. We'd like to thank Patrick Devlin. You can find him under the Twitter handle at MagicDrop5. Kay Shaw, my co-host over on To the Journey. You can find her on Twitter under the handle at ChocoWeeble. Norman Lau, you can find him at Starfighter1701, and Mark Walker from Parts Unknown.
No pushy peddlers in that crowd.
Well, once more, we'd like to invite you to discover more about our sponsor, Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. And check out audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, just visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to MetaTrex, a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.